degree wet bulb, your tower's going to be running full out, the fan, trying to get 60, all right? We can fix that too, all right? And it's called approach to wet bulb control. What we do is we measure the wet bulb of our towers, the approach to wet bulb. In other words, you're just doing a performance test on it. You then put that in as a set point, all right, or as a differential. Building automation systems almost always for enthalpy control calculate wet bulb temperature. So what we do, if we have a 72 degree wet bulb and we have a 5 degree approach tower, our set point is 77. Because we know we can't get to 60, okay? What that will do is your fans, instead of running 100% all the time trying to get there when they can't, will now maybe run at 40% if they're on a VFD, okay? So it's a much better way to control your towers, and you've pretty much got all the data you need other than measuring the approach to your, the approach on your tower, all right? You've already got the wet bulb. Since we're on to that, let's talk about VFD. I mean, cooling towers are a great place for them, pumps, air handlers, you know, you name it. But why? All right. Let's say we have a 100 kW motor. So at 100 kW, that motor is going to draw at 100% flow off the device, whether it's a fan on the cooling tower or a fan in the air handler, it's going to draw 100 kW. With a VFW, as soon as I'm down to 80% flow, look what happens to my electrical draw. It's dropped in half. All right. Even better yet, when I'm at 50% flow, I'm now only at 12.5% of the power. All right, so VFDs, wherever you can install them, do it. All right, it's tremendous savings. Cooling towers are a great place to start because it doesn't affect anything else. You don't have to change out three-way valves to two-way valves and do all this other stuff. So, and the reason that works is because with the VFD, the power savings are the cube of the flow reduction. All right. So these are some VFD applications that we've done. You know, I'm sure you have similar stuff. You know, one classic one people always overlook is boiler feed pumps, because all the old boiler systems were meant to, you know, had a pump for each boiler and you circulate all this water and you only use 10% of it. You know, cut that loop off, make it a direct feed, run it off of pressure. And I think we reduced our pumping horsepower for two boilers. We'd normally be running 60 horsepower with the pump, worth of pumps. We now do that with a 15 horse motor on a VFD. Okay, so 75% savings, not including the VFD savings. All right, simple things. I mean, even our medical air compressors are on VFDs. Water side economizers, this is going to be dependent somewhat on your climate, but you guys are all in pretty cold climates, so this is a good thing for you to do. Okay, now, where are you from anyway?
Texas.
Yeah, not going to work there probably. Well, I don't know. I don't have to look at it. But essentially what you do with the water side economizer is this sits in parallel with the chiller, okay? And when we have appropriate wet bulb temperatures outside and we can lower our condensing water to, let's say, 40 degrees, you know, we can directly cool the building through a heat exchanger rather than running a chiller. You know, in Pennsylvania, we find that saves us about 1,400 hours a year on our chillers, okay? The other thing that's really nice is that gives you chilled water capability year-round.
Do that.
You do that already?
Yeah.
Super.
Old enough,
that's
for sure.
Yeah.
The last 2 months.
Yeah, it's been cold since November, right? Air handler replacement, I mean, this isn't something you normally think has energy savings, but it indeed does. Generally, when we're doing this, we're adding VFDs to them. You're going to DDC controls, which saves you energy. We, as a standard, always use blenders and UV. You know, by using a blender, you're getting your temperature sensors, everything, all your heat transfer is much better because it's more uniform. You've got a uniform airstream, all right? You know, blenders aren't that expensive. They do take up a little bit of room, so if you're confined on space, it's sometimes an issue, but it does give you better performance from an energy standpoint on the air handler. Again, it's not huge dollars, all right? You know, $5,000, big deal. But as you start to inventory this stuff, every little bit's going to add up when you're going back talking to CFO, okay?
Have there been discussion or your experience with location devices?
As a standard, we have UV on all our air handlers. We don't do it for tuberculosis mitigation. We do it for our coils. I'm a firm believer that it can't hurt. I mean, we do see the effect on coil cleaning. It does keep our coils cleaner. Humidification, yeah, that's always a lot of times we don't have space in the air handler to do it in the final section, so it ends up being in the downstream ductwork. We've got installations where, you know, the original downstream ductwork is internally insulated, which is a huge issue, particularly. Yep. Yep. Yeah, there's no, I haven't found a good method of humidification. I mean, the one I'm sold on for, at least, we've got a very large data center, about 33,000 square feet, is to do like ultrasonic for a data center, because if you can put water in and let it evaporate, you're actually lowering the air temperature, you're adding more cooling, all right? So that makes sense to me. I mean, we don't normally have that need in the building so much, but in a building that's constantly in cooling, that's an asset. This is an idea we started years ago, and it's really very cheap to do, but we actually take all the condensate that comes out of our air handlers and put that back into our condenser loop for our makeup water. So in the summer, when you've got that inch and a half pipe running pretty full out of your air handler, all that is a spill recovery pallet that you put under a drum with a little giant sump pump in it. And we pipe it right back to the cooling tower. So when you're generating the most condensate is also when you have the greatest amount of cooling tower makeup. The beauty of this is it's absolutely pure water. There's no hardness. It's condensate, for God's sakes. And it's cold, because it's been cooled off the cooling coil. So it not only, almost eliminates your water makeup, but it's also water that doesn't need chemical treatment. So it reduces your chemical treatment because you're not treating the calcium and all the other stuff in the water to keep it from plating out, because it's not there. It doesn't exist. Okay. And I mean, $500 an air handler, that's probably including labor. I mean, the spill pallets are about $150 and the pump's about $75. And then some labor to put some copper or plastic piping into a condenser line. We also, in some instances, since we don't have any condenser lines in some equipment rooms, we will take that water and put it into our steam condensate return system, our steam receivers, because it's excellent boiler water. Okay? It's better than the water you're making for your boiler makeup. All right, other than temperature. There is a temperature penalty there. Medical air upgrade. We used to have, throughout our large complex, which grew over, 100 years, damn near, 25 medical air compressors. Each building as it was built kind of had its own med air system. Well, we've made all these common systems now throughout all our buildings. So we essentially went from 25 compressors to two. These are VFD compressors. The unique thing about them is, with your desiccant dryers, you've got a heating element to regenerate them and an air purge. So 15% of the compressed air you make is going to purge the dryer, all right? And, of course, you've got the heating penalty. With this system, all right, and this is an Atlas Copco option, the heat comes from the compressor, so there's no heating penalty. It's just waste heat, and there is no purge air. All right, the air that goes through to regenerate the desiccant goes right back into the intermediate stage, all right, and is taken out, and the moisture is taken out by the intercooler. All right, so, right off the bat, this is a 20 to 30% savings. If you're using a very efficient compressor today, it's at least a 25 to 30% savings over the most efficient system you might have. And depending what you have, it might be an even higher percentage. Okay, and obviously the maintenance on two machines is a lot less than 25 and all the other stuff. Vacuum pump, same kind of thing. We've gone to all waterless systems. I don't know how many are still running like old Nash pumps and things like that, but this is actually a reliability issue. The more utilities serve a system, the higher your incident of failure, because now if you have a water-cooled system, not only does water affect it, but also electric. So I have two chances rather than one for an outage. And, you know, our generator electrical systems are pretty secure with generation and things backing them up. Boiler upgrade, we have, these boilers were actually installed in 1968. So they're 40 years old, and we took a look at them at the time this slide was made, or 34, but, you know, we wanted to assess our boiler plant, you know, thought maybe we should start looking at replacing it, learned that the boilers were in great shape. We were told we had another 30 years in the tubes, you know, based on ultrasound testing. So we just opted for a burner option. This saved us in the first year $300,000. It was only a $300,000 project, so it was a one-year return. That was at $4 natural gas. I mean, we're back down there now, but, you know, last year we were at around 12. So that's 3 times 4, so that was probably $1 million worth of savings last year alone just on this burner retrofit, which is one nice thing about energy savings. I mean, it's, you know, one of the things Gina talks about, buying better, and that's a good option too, but, you know, I'm the guy that's always going to say use less, yeah, because that really pays me a bigger dividend, okay? Also, the other curious thing about this, we used to have economizers on these boilers. We had to remove them because they became so efficient, we didn't have sufficient stack temperature, you know, so proof is in the pudding. High purity boiler feed water, we talked about our condensate from air handlers can feed that. But we started looking at how do we do heat recovery from our blowdown. Yeah, I mean, depending how much you blow down your boiler, that water is 350 degrees going to sewer, you know. And then we tend to like to think different, so we thought, well, why do we blow down? Well, we blow down to get rid of, you know, calcium and hardness and all those things. It's like, well, okay, why don't we get rid of that shit beforehand? Not have to blow down. So what we've done is we've put RO systems on our boiler feed water. All right? Totally eliminated blowdown. I mean, the only blowdown we do is a mud blow once a day to get any settlement, any iron oxide out of the bottom of the boiler, and that's it. So we save water, we save temperature, you know, we save heat loss, and we save chemical treatment. Our chemical treatment reduces greatly. And I mean, these units are maybe only 15 grand a piece. Pretty easy to save 15 grand. You know, when you're accounting for this stuff, you know, it's like, here's another one, like, you know, we put awnings up and made so we could, you know, redid our front entrances. But the bottom line is in this, that this building elevation is facing due south, and that's the main concourse and underneath, you know, beyond those windows. And we had one hell of a cooling load in the winter. So by doing this, you know, by spending the money to spruce up the front entrance and some other things, we actually reduced our cooling load because all of a sudden we didn't have temperature issues anymore. All right? So again, as you're putting this stuff together, as you accomplish it, if there's something there you can take credit for with the CFO, take credit on your spreadsheet. All right. Incinerator replacement. I don't think anybody's running an incinerator anymore. We actually, for all 60 sites, destruct at one central facility. You know, obviously, an incinerator had a, you have heat recovery on it, but it's still an energy hog, you know, with the ID fans and all that stuff. This machine's got like a half horse motor on it for the HEPA filter. About the biggest expense on it is the shredder, running the shredder drives. But, you know, our cost for waste is 8 cents a pound. So, you know, normally. What's that? Obviously, that's going to vary by your state laws. We can only process infectious. We cannot process pathological or chemotherapeutic.
Should you put medical waste in there?
Yeah, that's medical waste. Yep. Yep, it comes out like confetti. And it's, you know, Pennsylvania's are probably the toughest regulations for sterility. It actually has to be sterile. It's got to be a 6-log reduction.
Ozone microwave,
though? It's merely steam. It shreds first. We spray it with some chlorine dioxide, which we make for Legionella mitigation, which we can, I don't know if that's in here or not. And then it goes in, that thing going up to the left, kind of that incline, is a 18-inch auger conveyor. That's a double-walled chamber that's heated by steam. The auger has steam heat in it, and there's also a couple of ports for direct steam impingement on the waste that run for, you know, seconds per minute. So retention time in that auger is probably somewhere around an hour. That auger is only turning at less than one revolution per minute. Turns extremely slowly, and it just tumbles the waste against the heated walls and sterilizes it.
Local authorities or state authorities checking in?
Oh, yeah. Because we do all off-site waste from our other hospitals and clinics, we are, in essence, a commercial facility. So we've got, we're licensed. Yeah, we do not fall under permit by rule.
Your regular waste guys, dumpsters, are you comfortable with it, or is it required?
Yeah, no. Landfill dumps it, same fee, same tipping fee as all our other compactor waste. Not an issue. We do run a culture every 40 hours, and we actually send a culture through the machine, and we culture it for 3 days. We're good to ship after 24 hours, because if it's going to cloud at all, it's going to cloud in the first 24. But we culture it for the full 3 days.
Remember what it cost you to build that?
Yep, $300,000. They've escalated in price since then. I just priced one the other day because I'm thinking of adding one at a site 60 miles away, because right now we've got a horrendous, our service territory is probably 100 mile radius. And so we're also licensed hauler. We've got 3 trucks on the road picking up waste. So to reduce the logistics of that, we're looking at adding a machine 60 miles away. That machine probably today is between $500,000 and $600,000. Okay. Elevators, oops, I'm sorry. Another one you don't really think has, you know, has much of a value, but, you know, you do get improved service you want to take credit for, and also by getting rid of MG sets, there is an energy savings by going to SCR drives. All right, so account, but we've done every elevator over in our main facility that was an SCR drive. They all are today. Oh, yeah, well, it's, depends on what contract you have. We're actually, well, I mean, but you can go, we've gone actually beyond, God, I don't know if I can say this in mixed company. We've negotiated on top of the Premier contract with Otis prepayment clauses. So in other words, what we do on our elevator upgrades is we prepay them. We give them cash up front. I mean, they're our dedicated long-term partner, which nets us another like 10% discount. So if we're going to do an elevator upgrade, or if we're buying a new elevator for a building, we're going to, when we order it, we're paying them. And that gets us an extremely large discount beyond what we get from Premier. This one's, we're all right on time. Yeah, we're pretty good. Steam trap monitoring. I don't know who does this, who doesn't. You know, the downside, you know what? There's an interesting story with everything you do. The interesting story with this is that, you know, my guys convinced me that this is something we ought to do, so, okay, you know, I'll fork up the money for it. And the devices definitely work. You do get, you know, particularly if you're on a humidifier or something, you'll get some false readings, but you learn where they are. But what was bothering me, when I'd walk through equipment rooms, I'd see yellow and orange lights on that are supposed to be green. And which meant that, you know, the guys weren't reacting to what the system was telling them to do. And what we do is we do equipment rounding 3 times a week. Each guy's assigned an equipment room. They've got an hour, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, because I'm a firm believer of eyes, ears, touch. You know, that's an important form of preventive maintenance. So we had the next departmental meeting. I said, look, you know, you guys wanted to do this. I banked on $50,000 worth of savings on the system. If I'm not going to get it in steam, I'm going to get it in salary. Compliance skyrocketed. So, I mean, this is a project we just finished up, chilled water storage. Kind of interesting. You know, we were able to negotiate. And you know, one of the things that's going to happen is as you get a plan evolved and you get credibility with the CEO and you're a good investment, it's amazing you start to be able to shape things better. We were building a 334,000 square foot building that was going to entrap my chiller plant. you know. So what we did is we turned that around into a strategy saying, okay, look, let's relocate the chiller plant. You can take over the existing mechanical space. If that would vacate, that's less mechanical space you have to build in the new project, all right, which has a savings to it, obviously, so we reduce the square footage. We were actually relocating all the chillers except one because they were all, the oldest one, well, the oldest one was about 15 years old, and it was one we didn't want to keep anyway. So we replaced one chiller in the scheme, but we're actually adding this 334,000 square foot building without adding any chillers. Okay, we had three chillers in the old plant, same three chillers in the new plant, and a chilled water storage tank. All right, the reason being, your peaks occur from, you know, what, 12 to 2, all right? You never use all your installed capacity except for that short period of time, and the rest of the time it's run at 30, 40%. So it's a chilled water storage tank allows you to do, number one, it's cheaper than a chiller, believe it or not. I mean, this tank costs us, you know, a chiller with all its ancillaries, let me clarify that. This is equivalent of a 900-ton chiller running for 8 hours or 9 hours. And at night when we're not using all our chiller capacities, we only charge a tank. All right, so during the heart of the day, you know, instead of bringing on another machine, you just start drawing water from the tank. What's that do for you? I mean, a chiller alone with its ancillaries for us is about a megawatt of load. So all of a sudden we've added a 334,000 square foot building without adding any electrical demand. Okay, we will add some kilowatt hours, but running the chillers at night, you've got better approach temperatures on your towers. All right, it's colder out, it's easier to reject heat, so your chiller efficiency goes up. All right, and you don't have to buy any capital equipment. It doesn't require any maintenance. You know, I don't need a maintenance contract for $20,000 or something on a tank. You know, so just a different strategy to go to. How many people have UPSs on CAT scanners, MRIs? How many?
We probably got well, maybe total.
UPS systems.
Small to very large.
Why?
Well, the most recent one was when we were doing our 4-hour generator test.
Mm-hmm.
It was a case of one on the OR. Went over emergency power lane perfectly except the computer based.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, so we've gone from analog to digital. All of a sudden, ventilators, everything else, don't just pick up where they left off. They reboot and need to be reprogrammed. What we're going to talk about here is this. It's not only high-efficiency UPSs, it's a centralized UPS. All right. We offer UPS as a utility. All right. So instead of having all these standalone UPSs serving different things, we've got one 900 kVA N plus one unit. Okay. Now you think 900 kVA, well, what's that going to do? You know, three CAT scanners, big deal. Well, the beauty about UPSs and the loads that we impose on them is that there's one hell of a diversity factor. All right. MRIs, CAT scanners, all other things draw current only for a fraction of a second. And the probability of that, of any two hitting at the same time, almost doesn't exist, okay? Although this is a 900 kVA unit, all right, we've got 3,600 kVA of load connected to it. And it is only 20% loaded, all right? So, you know, for a much smaller investment, all right, then installing all these standalone systems, you put it in as a central system. And we not only have all our radiology on this, MRIs, CAT scanners, this is our normal power supply for all 26 of our operating rooms. Okay? And we're still only 20% loaded on a 900 kVA unit. And you're probably putting a 250 or 300 on a CAT scanner.
You got a 600.
So you've got the good basis for a system. Okay? What I'm telling you to do is that the diversity of these devices is such that you can hook them all together and you'll never see it. That 600 will probably carry your entire facility. Make faces all you like, huh?
All your eggs in one basket.
Well, I mean, ours is a 900N plus one. So what we have is four 300 kVA modules.
Oh.
All right, so we, and there are, I mean, it's we use a Caterpillar system. And so if you lose a cabinet, you know, there's another one running. So we can take one down for maintenance without interrupting the system. The other thing with the UPS is that you're probably using double conversion with batteries. All right, batteries are absolute weak link in any system. You know, one shorted cell, the whole thing's dead. Yeah, they're in series. All right, so we don't use batteries on any UPS anymore. We use all flywheel technology. All right, lower maintenance costs, higher, less probability of failure. The other thing that it allows you to do with this type of unit, well, first of all, we don't do double conversion either. So you're, I mean, typically UPSs destruct all the AC wave into DC with a rectifier. Then you rebuild it by firing SCRs to build a pulsed AC. That's very energy intensive. They, you know, electrically, that's about an 80 to 85% electrical efficiency. We use what would be called a line interactive unit. All right. And what that does, if the AC is perfect coming in, it doesn't do a damn thing. Okay. You put a choke on the electrical line between, you know, between your power source and the UPS. And so the UPS really only comes into play when there's a sag in the line or a spike, all right? It's going to absorb that, or it's going to flow power to build that sag to where it ought to be.
All right, so we have MGE, though.
MGE. So that there's much less energy consumption, much less air conditioning requirement to maintain it, all those things. Much smaller footprint. I mean, my 900 kVA unit is probably from that door to that picture, and that's it, you know, 3 feet deep, no batteries, no nothing, it's all encompassed in that area. So yeah, it depends how much battery backup you're carrying,
right?
You know,
what did that cost them?
Do you remember
that installation was about $600,000. Yeah, to run the entire facility.
Were the UPS systems like the CAT scanner, how much are that? I mean, that's something, you know,
probably $100,000 a piece.
That's what I've heard about.
Yeah.
But one of the things that, quite frankly, took me by surprise in the sense that it always did math to work. You know, all of a sudden you get your CT, the last minute they say, oh, we need a
the UPS that all the time. You know.
The manufacturers.
What does everybody else do? You talk to GE or wherever. Nobody gets hit. They don't have that. You guys, you're the only ones who are doing this.
Yeah.
You know, because of power or what. So all of a sudden we got into this trend of everything had a UPS to it. The only thing that we, not the only thing, but one of the things we made a very conscious decision about was for the cardiac cath rooms. There, the decision we made was not to put them on emergency power, but not because of the cost. But we put them on a UPS because last thing we wanted to do was to have a boot up.
In the middle of a, yep, can't see where the catheter is.
For, I don't know, 60 or 70 minutes or something, which would be more than adequate time to get out. And then the OR thing was just a, but really, you know, I mean, I think it's a great idea. For some reason, there wasn't a lot of attention about this, you know, 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah. We actually started with centralized UPS in 1989, with our first system. And I will tell you, you know, there are formulas within the IEEE that as you start agglomerating imaging units and all, you only have to take credit for like 1/20th of their draw. And even that's way conservative. All right.
I think people just thought, knew you had generation, so they didn't, mm-hmm. They didn't think much more about it than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll go down and come back, but.
Yeah, but now in the age of electronics and computers and robots, and they can't take the hit. I mean, I know when we interrupt our robotic rooms, I mean, it's like an hour for them to reboot and reprogram and recalibrate, because they have to recalibrate the unit that it's actually doing what it's supposed to do. There's a whole process. So. Yeah, having it as a central utility will be a huge capital savings, huge operational savings, because maintenance and other things is, I mean, you got to go through the batteries twice a year at least, sometimes four times. So something to consider, all right, something to put in your plan, all right. Some of the things we're working on currently, we just talked about the chilled water storage tank. That's actually online right now. Actually, we're kind of doing something different. We're because we're just commissioning probably next week that new chiller plant. We needed a heat load, and of course, that's not easy to come by in the middle of February in northern Pennsylvania. So actually, what we did is we took our condenser water through an exchanger. We're actually heating the tank. We've got the tank at a nice toasty 65 degrees, and that will then become our heat load to commission the chillers. Okay, so we'll run the chillers on against the tank, saved us from running boilers and the heat load. We're installing them. This sounds crazy, particularly if you're from the Northeast, but an electric off-peak boiler, 6 megawatts, based on rate structures. We will actually be able to lower our unit cost of power by a penny a kilowatt hour by increasing our load factor. So in other words, we'll use much more power at night than we do during the day. And obviously, electric, you know, the other benefit of an electric boiler, you know, is its efficiency. All right, a gas boiler is 83%, thereabouts, 85 if you're lucky. Electric boiler is 99.5. There's no stack, so there's no, you get everything. That's kind of interesting. I mean, it's a 12,000 volt boiler. It actually works on electrical arc. You flow water across two electrodes and the water conducts electricity and makes steam. We're also going through, just did a feasibility study on cogen again, but for the first time that I've been involved in it, it's actually starting to look like it's making financial sense in the current marketplace.
What are you going to say to the electric boiler? Should you switch to that?
With the electric boiler? Probably about $700,000 a year unit savings on our electric. You know, I mean, it's really dependent upon what the current gas price is, because we'll be displacing gas with electric at an off-peak rate. So, I mean, per unit of steam, it will actually be, if you just looked at steam production, it's actually more expensive to make it on the electric boiler. But if you look at the effect on the electric bill by increasing load factor, the rates work such that it actually makes it cheaper. I'll have to explain that one to you. leads. If you're not building leads buildings, best thing you can do for your job, because all of a sudden you're not going to have to fight for getting the right stuff in buildings up front. You're going to get them commissioned. You're going to, you know. So we were fortunate enough to convince our CEO to commit to building all leads buildings. So we're doing that. This is the first one we did, and that was a LEEDS Silver. We just got a LEEDS Gold last week and are expecting another LEEDS Gold next week or sometime in the next month. So, but it definitely makes your job easier. In fact, this building's kind of interesting. This was one where we struggled because they wanted to, you know, go to a cheaper air conditioning system. I actually committed some of my infrastructure funding, and what we did in the adjacent building, I had a 500-ton chiller plant. No, that's wrong. 1,000-ton chiller plant that cooled the west end of the hospital as well as our research center. But it was a 1985 York turbomodulator, first of the VFDs. We actually ended up in, you know, outside the project with infrastructure funding from my pot, put in a new chiller plant in the basement of this building, all right, a 1,500-ton plant. And the interesting thing is the net electrical usage for that end of the campus decreased because the savings on the much more efficient chillers was greater than what the LEEDS building consumed. All right, so we had a net energy increase of less than zero. You know, we actually decreased energy usage. So, wrap this up, and hopefully have some time for discussion. Yeah, obviously what we're talking about is a planned approach, something we can sell to the CFO. Replacement of assets, of our facilities assets, increase of reliability, safety, and cost. you know, you guys know better than anybody where your opportunities exist. I mean, sounds like you're all there for quite a while, and you're all been in this business a long time, and try to get a return on every dollar you spend. Okay, now let's have a discussion. Yeah, that's what's on my business card. Yep. Well, like, you know, like, people don't understand when, you know, I'm facilities operation, you know, what's that? But they understand when you say I'm the facilities guy. Oh, okay. I don't know if they think I'm the janitor or what, but they somehow seem to comprehend that better.
Any experience with biodiesel?
No. I mean, we have biodiesel in the area. I know some of my guys run it in their trucks. We haven't run it in a boiler plant. Of course, we run very little oil. We haven't run it in our generators yet. So, no. I don't think there's any issues with it that I'm aware of. I mean, if you're doing testing and you're doing, you know, fuel conditioning.
Yeah, we're just really doing feasibility studies because there is a question about separation and storage tanks.
Yeah, I don't know enough about it.
To be green, not that it's, you know, it's like 5%, but if you've got generators that run, you've got pressure intakes nearby, people like to smell these things from generators. It's a good opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, we've talked to a couple of, we've talked to Cass. They're not real warm and fuzzy about it.
Yeah, you're probably right. It's different in a mobile engine because you're turning your fuel over much, but, you know, we're us. I don't know how reliable your utilities are. I mean, we see a utility outage about once every 3 to 4 years because we sit on a dedicated 69,000-volt line, transmission line.
We have a cool substation too. So
yeah, we do too. Yeah.
In fact, we're testing. It's the only reason we use the fuel.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, actually, we just had to get into I don't know, you're probably not big enough to be a synthetic miner. I mean, we used to be a Title V facility, which is an EPA air quality thing, and now we're a synthetic miner. But because when we run generators, you know, we've got a 5.6-ton limit on NOx emissions a year, all right? And they break that down to the hour. So, I mean, we can't emit more than 100 pounds of NOx per hour. Well, if we run all our generators, which we just had to do for some electrical work to add in a new building, we exceeded that number. But that number is calculated on the rated capacity of the generator. Now, we've probably got 9 megawatts of generation. But, you know, if we have 3 or 4 megawatts connected, it's probably a lot. Okay. So what we're actually doing now is installing fuel monitoring that we found in the marine industry. Like what the fishing boats use, so they know, you know, when they go out fishing, they know they have enough fuel to get back. So what it does is it calculates, it measures what's coming to the generator, what's going back to the tank. Of course, the difference being the usage, which then lowers our NOx calculations to the government down to a threshold where that's not an issue. But, you know, it's just stupid. Oh, yes, I know. Yeah, Region 2. Oh, you're under Region 2 EPA, too, right? Are you?
So.
Which is the ones that really went after the pharmaceutical waste and
right.
Pioneered all that fiasco. Yeah, I sold one once and tried to sell it again because I sold it for, it wasn't much, $5,000. A guy was going to tear it out, but he never took it. But we got to $5,000, so we just finally tore it out.
I'm intrigued by that. Your medical waste, a guy come and show us ozone treatment for it, blue shredder. That's a pretty hefty ticket, but it's a real hefty expense.
Mm-hmm.
The cost, I worry a little bit about how it's going to pay for itself pretty quickly, but if you're in a small community, if word gets out that you're shredding your medical waste, don't worry, it's okay. We're just going to dump it in the landfill.
Well, you can't get in a smaller community than we're in. We're located in a town of 5,000 people. We employ, just on that one campus in that town, over 8,000 people. Then there's truly not an issue.
What did you pay for your unit, your sterilizer shredder?
Well, at the time, we paid around $300,000. It's escalated in cost. You know, a lot of those technologies scare me. I mean, steam sterilization is pretty tried and true. You know, like I've looked at microwave units, I've looked at all kinds, and you know, my God, the microwave units, it's a panel as long as this room of electronics. Wow, what's the reliability of that? You know, well, and who do I got to work on it?
I think ozone's been around long enough now where that's a pretty reliable.
Yeah, I just don't know the science with disinfecting waste.
That's the problem, it's convincing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, is it a technology that's permitted by your state? Have they tested it? All those things. So, other questions? You guys have back been kind of quiet. Problems I can help you solve?
Can I
No.
How do you get the medical waste to this? What's your process within the hospital to this particular medical waste unit?
Well, because the medical waste unit has a cart dumper. We've adopted a DOT-approved cart, all right, that is sealed, gasketed, because, you know, we use the same cart throughout the system, you know, whether it's at our clinic sites or other hospitals, because they all got to go in a truck and get to us, all right. So, within the hospital where the unit sits, I mean, these carts are located in a sold utility room. You know, they're filled during the day by housekeepers, and there's a transport person moves them up to the unit.
So they're filled on the unit, and then they're sealed
closed
on the unit, so they can be transported through the hospital to the unit.
Mm-hmm.
And then the unit hooked up to the sterilizer to open it.
Well, we just open it. It's got a cart dumper, so we essentially open a door, open the lid of the cart, push it into the unit, close the door, push a button. It
so
dumps.
All done in a closed
yeah.
thing after it's
open. Yeah, and I mean, the amazing thing is we've totally eliminated sharp sticks from waste handling, you know, by housekeepers, by incinerator operators, you know, because we used to have to handle bags previously, you know.
So,
we don't ever handle bags now.
The reason I ask about the transport is because the one incident with waste shredding is it was coming on an open, you know, in one of the waste companies that had Stericycle. This was plant up in Washington State, and it was coming on the belt with the plastic flap that they have on the, you know, and everybody, all these people got tuberculosis because they had open plates and stuff. So
no, this is
totally closed.
Right.
System, so
this
no
dumps it in. You know, there's doors open, allows it to dump, then they close. And that chamber is evacuated by a fan that discharges through a HEPA filter.
Oh, that's fabulous.
So.
Any other questions for Al? We are right at the...
Right at on time.
Did you hear some interesting ideas?
Yeah. I mean, if you guys have any questions to think of later, want to know something about equipment, whatever, give me a call. There's a phone number. More than happy to help. I mean, I served on a Premier Facilities Committee for 10 years, chaired it for a while. So I'm reasonably familiar with most of the contracts and that stuff.
That's all right.
But so, good luck.
Yeah. So you'll share your slides in a PDF?
Sure, if you like. Well, you have it. You're going to handle that since you have a PDF?
Yeah, I have a PDF.
Okay.
This might not be the right time to ask it, but what does Premier do now in regards to their facilities? I know a few years ago it sounded like it goes from inertia, they get people together periodically and have sessions, but then it kind of...
We're actually doing, this year, 24 regional facilities meetings. So we pull together facilities directors kind of in their geography so they can drive 2-3 hours max. And we have subject matter experts come in typically and talk about updates to life safety code assessments, JCO environmental care. Actually, when you plan a study, typically does that. We'll have some content typically from one of our suppliers. They'll provide some, a particular track, SME content. Suppliers will come, they actually fund the meetings. There's an opportunity to interact with some of our suppliers in this environment. Typically like an 8 to 2 or 3 o'clock deal. And often they're attended by facility directors and accompanied by supply chain person. So we're doing 24 of those. And I can get the schedule or let you know when the meeting or whatever it is going to be. But we try to pretty much cover broad. And maybe you guys have something else you're doing, Jeff?
No, but we actually put a lot of work into these folks here in town.
Okay.
Yeah, we did do something recently. Certainly, we actually have this.
I have a great facility stuff in a lot. The only premier stuff I get, they're often wearing Chicago dress.
Yeah.
Well, I was in Chicago, but I haven't seen.
Are you listed? I mean, the full information office is Siegel. If you're not listed in the Siegel, that might be a disconnect.
Yeah.
We don't have a lot of facility managers in the database. I've been trying to reach them.
I don't get anything.
You don't get anything?
No. Most, it all goes to materials management, never.
I wonder if there is a way that somebody can reach out directly to the hospital and get the answer.